It's Monday, August 3rd, 2020, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington from New York, joined shortly by our managing editor, Ed Harrison. But first, with today's stories, Nick Correa.
Thanks, Ash. Congress remains at odds with no extensions to enhanced unemployment benefits and no agreements made on what the next relief bill will shape up to be. Some Republican lawmakers throughout the past week have offered a piecemeal approach through passing smaller bills in order to reinstate programs like enhanced benefits. However, this has been rejected by Democrats, who are more in favor of a comprehensive bill. Coming to a consensus on the new bill still seems to be out of reach. With enhanced benefits having officially passed an end date on Friday, let's consider what might be at stake and what might show up in the data in the coming weeks. The Household Pulse Survey, led by the Census Bureau, is a measure of how households are faring during the coronavirus pandemic. In week 7 of their data collection, which would account for the week June 11th through the 16th, they started to gather data on stimulus payments and its effect on the American population. In the survey, one question they asked concerned the sources of income used in the past 7 days to meet expenditures, and respondents could select multiple answers. Together with its weighted system and other data compiled from other bureaus, the survey had approximated responses to the size of the U.S. population, 18 years and older. From weeks 7 through 12, reliance on UI benefits for spending rose from 12.90% to 14.42%, and for stimulus checks, it had decreased from 26.06% to 19.60%. The expenditure categories that are the highest in terms of where stimulus checks had gone to were food, utilities and telecommunications, rent and mortgages, household supplies and personal care, as well as paying down debt, saving, and investing. With the combination of enhanced benefits and stimulus checks rolling off about the same time, as well as some delays for people receiving checks via mail, it could have an impact on how much the checks will still be utilized for some. But it shows that the effect decreases quickly, whereas UI has somewhat of a baseline for overall aggregate spending. This dynamic could change with new legislation, or lack thereof. We'll be keeping track of it all over the coming weeks, and we'll update you as the situation evolves. With that said, let's send it back over to Ash.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Thanks, Nick. Welcome back, Ed.
Good to be here. I could say unhappy Monday because as I look out, I see that it's we have a storm brewing outside here in the D.C. area.
Yeah, what's the name of this tropical storm?
If you asked me to pronounce it, I would probably butcher it, so I'm not going to even try.
Ed, coming from you, the polyglot, that's quite an impressive statement.
Yeah, they have the accent on the second to last syllable, and I think that throws me off. Or maybe it was even I think it's the second to last syllable. It's difficult to pronounce.
Well, not my forte. Let's jump right in. You started credit write-downs out this morning with quite a lead. We are in the middle of a grand social experiment right now.
Yeah, you know, and by the way, that's a drinking term for everyone who's listening, because people say if you don't mention credit write-downs at least once, and they're going to have to drink. So you just did it right off the bat. I really like that. So for those of you playing that drinking game, you know, get in there, make it happen. And, you know, you're right on the money, because I wanted to follow up with what Nick was saying to us about the fiscal cliff, because actually the post was supposed to be about the fiscal cliff and a potential double dip. Really, it's more than anything about the second wave and also what I would call the unsustainability of this grand experiment, this social distancing that we're going through. I mean, from my perspective, just as a personal perspective, I was thinking of it in terms of my son's own desire not to come home at the requisite time yesterday, and his difficulty in social distancing himself. You know, as a 14-year-old, a very social, outgoing kid who is being forced to not go to school in September and October because they're doing virtual schooling here in the county that that I live in, Montgomery County, Maryland. So I think this is where we all are right now. And this is likely where we're going to be in these kinds of thinking for the foreseeable future, just because we're in the middle of a second wave, not just here in the United States, but globally as well.
Yeah, you know, that's actually a great lead into what I was going to ask you next. You've been doing a deep dive, I think, in a way that's really compelling about the virus numbers around the world, the public policy response, and the impact on the economic outlook for those countries, especially in Europe. What are your thoughts right now? I know you mentioned Sweden specifically. Why is that important?
Yeah, I think that Sweden is the most controversial of them all. And I think that what precipitated my post today in terms of thinking of it from the viral perspective, other than the second wave, is the GDP numbers that are going to come out of Sweden. We saw numbers before from the United States and from the rest of Europe. Spain was a laggard. The United States was hit at negative 32.9%. That's an annualized figure, which is 9.5% on an actual basis. But Sweden, supposedly, they're going to come in at 7%. So that's going to be better than the United States, better than the 19-member euro area. And then the question is it worth it? You know, how do we look at this in terms of the sustainability of the response protocols that people have put into place in various places? And I mean, as a lot of people may know, despite the death toll in Sweden, I have some sympathy for their public health strategy, because the way that I understand it was designed to be sustainable. It was a sustainable new normal over the longer period of time, as opposed to an absolute minimization of viral contagion. They were thinking about what happens if the coronavirus problem stays with us for the longer term. How do we have a new normal that's sustainable, that we can continue in the same mode for a very long period of time? And so that's how I'm thinking of it right now, because the second wave that we're seeing in the United States in particular, but also to a lesser degree in other places. I think Victoria, Melbourne, the second largest city in Australia, is a perfect example. Those are places that are now in lockdown in Victoria. And the reason is because what was going on wasn't sustainable. Their protocols have been proved to not last over the long term. And so I think that that's going to be negative for their economy. And, you know, Sweden is looking better in some respects right now as a result.
Yeah, you know, a couple of things that you said jumped out at me there. First, the question, we've been talking about this internally at Real Vision, how these GDP numbers are reported. They're reported differently in the United States. They're reported on a annualized yearly rate, SAAR, seasonally adjusted annualized rate. So when you see a 32.9% drop, that's expressed over the year. And exactly as you pointed out, quarter over quarter, that's 9.5% contraction of U.S. GDP. You know, the second question that that sort of strikes me is, when you think about this, it's a very challenging bogey. You're talking about not just minimizing viral infections, but of course trying to minimize loss of life on the one hand, and two, managing this time horizon balance with what can we do in the short term to try and flatten the curve to the maximum extent possible, and then on the other hand, how do you build a sustainable strategy for operating in a way that minimizes the loss of life and infection while trying to preserve the economy? These are incredibly complex trade-offs.
Yeah, they really are, and I think that we're going to be going through it for quite a long time. You know, I have two or three things on my mind I want to get out today about this. One has to do with something that's happened with the cruise line industry recently. Remind me if I don't come back to that. Another is data that I saw out of Germany that gives you a sense of, you know, the levels that we're talking about here. So let me go through a few charts in Germany just to give you a sense of how I'm thinking about it. The first chart is a chart in yellow, which shows the number of new infections daily in Germany over a longer period of time. There's a red line on this chart, which shows you the 7-day moving average. And what you see there, and if you think about Germany not as a country that has had a really bad outbreak, but as someone that a country that's done fairly well, is a massive first wave. And you know, even though the numbers are trending up in the second wave, they are much lower than they were in the first wave. So that's an example of relative success in terms of the COVID crisis. Now, if you look at the R number, the reproduction number, interestingly enough, what you'll see is there was a big spike up when they came out of the COVID-19 crisis. They got it back down under control, but the numbers are still around the 1% level, the 1.0 level reproduction, which means for each person who's infected, they infect on average one other person. And that just shows you that what's happened is that they've done a great job in terms of getting people into these little clusters and then quarantining them and isolating them and not letting it spread out by testing and quarantining. That's one of the reasons that you don't see the second large bump the way that you have in the United States. Yeah. And then finally, let me add a third chart, which is the comparison of, you know, how many people per 100,000 residents have been infected with COVID-19 or confirmed to have been infected with COVID-19. The United States is at the top. Brazil comes in second. Sweden, which we were just talking about, comes in third on this chart. And the interesting bit is the slope of those lines. Obviously, you'll never slope downward because you always reach a certain level and then you either stay there or you go higher. A lot of the places like Sweden are in stasis. Italy is in stasis. Germany's largely in stasis. The United States and Brazil are rising rapidly. So their rates of detected infection are rising. So I think that, the bottom line there is that for me, some countries have been doing this better than other countries. And my expectation, therefore, is those countries will do better because the economic consequences of not controlling the virus are going to be felt in terms of how people shop, whether there are localized lockdowns, and in terms of just overall behavior all around. Let me just continue with this whole concept for a second here, because in terms of the economic consequences that I was talking about, let's look at them not just from the economy, but from the financial markets. There was a piece by Gavin Davies that I thought was very interesting on that. And the analysis that he made basically said that when researchers looked into evidence that equity price changes were explained by corporate earnings expectations during this pandemic, they didn't find any evidence there. What they found is that really what's going on is that the equity risk premium has been altered. It went way up as we went into a liquidity crisis in February and March, and then it's come back down after the Fed intervened. So really what we're seeing or what we have seen thus far during this pandemic is we've seen equity prices react as a result of a risk premium more than as a result of corporate earnings collapsing or improvements in terms of expectations of corporate earnings, what have you. My belief is that going forward, starting in the September-October timeframe that I've been talking about for some time, that what we are actually going to see going forward is that the risk premium is going to continue to be relatively stable, but it's the corporate earnings that are going to be the real push here. They're the ones that the corporate earnings are going to be the things that will take stocks up or down. So it's not going to be an absolute collapse into a liquidity crisis as we saw, but the proof is in the pudding in terms of these specific sectors of the economy, these specific companies, based upon how well they do in response to a second or a third or a fourth wave of the virus, which I completely believe will happen.
Yeah, I read that piece too in the FT, Gavin Davies, chairman of Fulcrum Asset Management. Exactly as you said, and exactly as kind of we've been discussing here now for weeks or months. Not, I think he used the phrase not rational, talking about in terms of the expectations of pricing relative to earnings, but all about cuts in the discount rate, increases in liquidity, and easing credit conditions. And then the final point that he made, which I thought was interesting, is that he talked about the Fed expressing potential unlimited policy action in the future. So the forward guidance component there as well being a factor that supported U.S. equity market valuations. And, you know, that brings me back to something that I've been looking at today, which is tech stocks, right? This is definitely a tech stock story. What we saw last week when big cap tech stocks reported earnings was earnings to the upside versus expectations and revenue to the upside. I think earnings a little bit stronger relative to expectations than revenue, but top and bottom line beats. Now, there were a little bit of maybe some amber warning signals that were flashing. Google posted its first year-over-year decline in revenue since they became a listed company. And Facebook reported a decrease in the velocity of earnings increases. So a second derivative effect, a deceleration, so to speak, in earnings. But look, NASDAQ 100 all-time high today. NASDAQ closing at all-time highs. These are some really some interesting signals. What we've talked about, the concentration of this market being in those very large cap tech stocks, who are of course doing very well as more of our lives become virtual. And I know you have some thoughts about that as well, in terms of the virtualization of our lives versus the kind of in real life component that I thought was interesting that you wrote about.
Yeah, you know, the way I'm internalizing it now, as opposed to this morning, has to do with a trifecta of cruise line announcements that I heard about. And the interesting bit is for me, in three different places: Norwegian Cruise Lines, there was in Tahiti another incident, and a third in Italy that happened, all of which were about quarantining and COVID infections on these cruises. And if you remember, we were talking back in May about Norwegian Cruise Lines hitting the books with a $600 million upsized to $675 million bond issue, because, you know, after the Fed came in, there was appetite for risk. People wanted to risk on. I think this deal got off at like a 12.5% IRR. And people were like, you know, 12.5%, it's collateralized. This is a great deal. Let's do it. Let's make it happen. Now we come back a few months later. Here we are in the month of August. That's 3 months later. And Norwegian is basically shutting down its operations because they've had a COVID outbreak in the second wave. To me, that tells you how this is going to play out without a vaccine, because everyone is banking on the vaccine to give us a bailout. Let's call it, this is how I'm thinking of it. It's a bailout. People are thinking we want the medical bailout, the vaccine, and so that everything can go back to normal. But what if actually we don't get that bailout? What if this is the normal, the new normal? Then companies like Norwegian are going to hit the wall. That is, that they're not going to be able to roll over their debt continuously because of these kinds of ruptures. And so when you talk about the virtual world, yes, you're going to have a bifurcation there, where there's going to be a continual move away from these types of activities towards activities that will make people feel safe and that they can control in this new normal that we're living in.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was teeing up. I think those are some great points. I hadn't heard anyone refer to the vaccine as a medical bailout before, but that really is an interesting metaphor. It is kind of the panacea or the magic bullet that everyone's hoping will solve all the problems. But, you know, I think you're spot on this, with this bifurcation issue between the virtual and the real. You know, I was reading, I think we discussed a little bit earlier, the Rana Faruhar piece in today's FT as well. And, you know, she's definitely kind of grokking your view on that, that basically there's like this division between the real world and the virtual world, and travel and transportation are one of the major dividing lines there. And if you have a major collapse in the way that people move around the country and around the world, for that matter, you see a major change in the way that we lead our lives, the way we do business, and the way the economy functions.
Right. Yes. And so getting to what she was saying and putting it together with what I'm saying if we do not get the medical bailout that a vaccine represents, then the lives that we're living now are, in a sense, a new normal. Remember, I'm thinking of Sweden as the bogey, eventually moving toward the least restrictive movements possible over the longer term in that sort of scenario, that we're going to hopefully move in that direction, but the new normal won't be like the old normal. Right. And so if you put that together with what she's saying that there's going to be basically an absolute collapse in certain types of arrangements, like travel as we knew it isn't going to happen. So before this, we got on, I was drinking out of this absolutely crazy sized mug that I bought in Cozumel in Mexico, because we used to vacation there every year. We're not going there this year. That's not going to happen. I'm not going to the Starbucks in that area because of COVID-19. Instead, I might go to Long Beach Island. I might go to the Delmarva Coast, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. Yeah. So that's what's going to happen. And what that means ultimately is, again, you have this bifurcation. And during that time, there's going to be a massive change. It's not just going to be winners and losers. It's going to be a shift, a change, and therefore a downshift in terms of growth overall, nominal growth coming down, less consumption, more unemployment. It's going to be a very long, hard slog. And I think that only now, as we're getting into the second wave, are we starting to realize that this is the case. I feel that the second wave will accelerate and also increase the number of bankruptcies that we're going to see starting in the fall.
Yeah. You know, and it also makes me wonder about the second order effects on this, the animal spirits impact effect. You know, I never forget how lucky we are to be able to do this, what we do, and to have an audience who's been loyal to us at Real Vision Daily Briefing throughout this crisis. But I often think back to jobs that I've had in the past when I was working in banking and different things where I was physically in person. I mean, my life would be totally turned upside down right now. If it weren't for the fact that we were in this small minority of people who were able to do their jobs and live their lives relatively well virtually. That's not the case for most people in the country.
No, and most people in the entire world.
Yeah.
So being able to move to a situation in which you can actually move around and feel safe in this new normal, it's going to take us a wild transition to get there. And again, we can't rely on a vaccine to make that happen. Now, going to the economy, just thinking about the economic factors here, because I think what Nick was talking to earlier today was about, you know, where people are spending their money when they're getting the pandemic unemployment assistance, and that's going away. And again, I think that that will be an accelerant for this transition to the bifurcation that we're talking about. But we had a minus 32.9, which is a 9.5% on an absolute basis decrease in Q2. Q3 in the United States is expected to be up some 17%. As I saw, the Atlanta Fed GDP Now numbers already tracking at 11%. But now what if, we don't get a resolution politically to the impasse in terms of re-upping the money that people need in order to survive that they're not getting because pandemic unemployment assistance has gone away. That 17%, that 11% GDP Now number, that gets cut dramatically. So that's where, you know, you could see Q3 or Q4 actually in real terms contract in a worst case scenario. All of this happening while we're in the midst of an election cycle, which makes it that much more politically charged, that much more violent. And I think that the downside risks are therefore manifest, and they will come due after the summer lull is over, without a doubt, if we don't get something in place very soon.
Yeah, I'm much more bullish on the American economy and the American people than I am in Congress's ability to come together and agree on sane, rational ways to limit the downside risks here. But, you know, it's something that we've talked about, and I think the two key words that we've been talking about today are sustainability, number one, and new normal, that we basically have this real shift, this transition. And the question is whether it's sustainable. I mean, we are still at a relatively short period of time here. And when winter comes around, it's also exacerbated by weather, or now another way of saying it would be it's eased by good weather. I can go out and walk around the block if I feel stir crazy in my, you know, in my apartment. There's the option of going and dining outside. In the Northeast, where a large percentage of the American population lives, and in other places of the country outside of the Southeast and the Southwest, there are going to be significant factors that are going to constrain people's activities as the cold weather comes. These are things that are a certainty.
Yeah, so I think the jury's still out as to whether our actions, our activities are sustainable over the longer term. Yeah. And that means that there's a lot more downside risk from COVID. We also don't know what's going to happen with regard to the policy apparatus. On the one hand, we have the problems in the Eurozone in terms of getting together and getting something. We have the exact same problems, but of a different nature in the United States. And I think those are the places where you can see more downside risk. I don't see, honestly, at this point, I'd like to hear your view in terms of where the upside is outside of a vaccine. So when I talk about the medical bailout, to me, that's why I'm looking at it that way, because that's the only thing that is potentially giving us any upside. To the degree that that vaccine date gets pushed back or becomes unrealistic, as the WHO just said today, you know, Mr. Tedros from the WHO in Geneva said, you know, we can't look at it as one silver bullet that's going to happen. If that seeps in, I think then people are going to have a completely different understanding about the new normal, that really we're in this not just for 2 months, 3 months, we're in it for 9 months, 2 years, something of that nature.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it in a very similar way. So I think it's vaccine. The question of how long a vaccine takes to develop, what the efficacy rates are. There's some discussion about a vaccine that may not be 100% effective. I saw the number 50% efficacy just tossed around loosely. So the question is, how effective is it? Also, how long does it take to distribute and deploy the vaccine until it can create enough of an impact in terms of herd immunity to stop the transmission? I guess the other thing that I would add to that, Ed, is the effectiveness of treatment, which has increased, obviously not increased nearly enough. It's not where we'd like it to be. But there's remdesivir. There are steroidal treatments. There's some of the protocols with putting people on ventilators have improved. So the mortality rate for this in the U.S. is declining, still obviously nowhere near where it needs to be. But more effective treatments, I think, could also be a pathway toward a renormalization of life here in the U.S., especially for populations who are less at risk. But all of that said, I think you're exactly right. That is, the medical bailout is a great frame. I like that. It makes a lot of sense. So I think it's treatment and vaccine. And then in terms of financial markets, it's what we were talking about earlier with the gentleman from Fulcrum. The question is to the extent to which fiscal and monetary policy will support U.S. and global risk asset prices. So it's the monetary side, credit easing and liquidity function, and then also on the fiscal side, the ability to support and stimulate the economy with fiscal policy. The president was talking today about potentially taking executive action to limit evictions. Obviously, keeping people in their homes is something that's a very popular political issue. What the impact and how that translates on to economic function remains to be seen. But yeah, I think those things that you mentioned, we're thinking about this in very similar ways.
Yeah, let me just finish off the conversation with the concept that these are unprecedented times. And I understand that the new economy, the virtual economy, is going to benefit to a certain degree. But it leaves me very uneasy to think that we're in the worst financial and economic crisis that we've had in more than three quarters of a century, almost a century, and stock prices have barely moved, that yeah, we're nearer the all-time highs than we are at the crisis lows. To me, that speaks to a lack of acceptance of the reality that faces us going forward. So we'll just have to see how this plays out. I do think it makes some sense to see the bifurcation that we're seeing now, but the aggregate picture that I'm seeing from the S&P 500, from index funds, et cetera, leaves me somewhat worried From junk bonds, I should add as well, in terms of the spreads that have happened there, worried that the downside risk has not been fully appreciated by markets, and that in the coming months, when the second wave, the effects are obvious, that we're going to see another sort of sell-off. I think that's where my worry is at this point.
Yeah, S&P closed today 32.94. All-time high, 33.93, so less than 3% off the all-time high. And, you know, I would just add to that, on a cyclical basis, U.S. entered recession in February of 2020. So in addition to the massive headwind we face as a result of this virus, there's a cyclical slowdown that was occurring anyway.
Yeah, so to be continued, but that's where I am today. It's a good day in the markets, but I remain a bit worried and a bit skeptical that this has legs beyond the summer.
Positive day in markets as we add that little bit of gray to the silver lining.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us, Ed.
Thanks, Ash.